From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 502, App Compatibility in Windows 10 with guest Chris Jackson, recorded Saturday, September 24th, 2016. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio, bringing back one of my favorite guests in the world. Chris Jackson is here. Let's see how old this bio is, sir. Chris Jackson is a worldwide lead for Enterprise App Compat. He's worked with enterprise customers around the world to help them investigate and mitigate application compatibility issues, as well as providing instructional training about Windows application compatibility for numerous industry events, including this one. Here we are at Ignite.
Yes, indeed, and very exciting.
And that's still basically accurate. This is still your job.
That's certainly a big part of what I do. And then the other part is also working specifically on security. And a lot of the work I do is specifically on client security. Obviously, as you might imagine, what has the biggest impact on compatibility? You turn the security feature on, app starts to break.
When is the first time you and I talked about UAC? I mean, it's got to have been 2007? Years. Yeah, maybe 9 years ago. So we've been doing the show for 10 years now. So it's
we are still trying to talk people into turning UAC back on.
Yeah.
That's actually one of the big, you know, blowbacks we're getting for Windows 10 is that people are realizing, oh, there's a real impact of having turned this off
right.
In terms of features and what's going to work.
And risk and so forth. We saw the keynote today, lots of conversation about helping protect users from clicking on the wrong thing and that sort of thing, that just minimizing the impact on all of that. But I do want to run a little bit down the Win 10 app compat path, because I presume Windows 10 has it nailed now. All software runs flawlessly. There's no problems at all.
Well, we've said that nearly every time, haven't we? It turns out if you have a Twitter alias of @appcompatguy, when Steven Sinofsky makes an announcement for Windows 7, that if it works on Vista, it works on Windows 7. If it
right.
worked on Windows 7, it works on Windows 8. He did it again.
Yes.
That suddenly your Twitter speed basically explodes.
Yeah.
With all the comments that are on there.
Because it doesn't always work out exactly that way.
Yeah. But it's really very interesting to me. To me, it comes down to where are you coming from?
Right.
And what technical debt did you take on?
Yeah. What are you still carrying with you? Because it's generally that's what's going to get you, is the technical debt you're still carrying.
Right. So the big ones that we're starting to see are everyone who's turned off UAC.
Right.
You know, because now if you turn off UAC, and it puts you in an unsupported configuration. Like, literally, we've done zero tests
wow.
with UAC disabled. We have no idea what happens.
So if you call PSS now, and they'll check whether or not UAC is running, and then what do they say?
Turn it on.
You have to turn it on.
But you don't have to. I mean, it's not a mandate.
If you want support.
If something doesn't work the way you expect.
Right.
And it's because you have turned off UAC,
mm-hmm.
we won't change it.
Yeah, we're not fixing that.
A great example to sort of how random it can be is it was in an IE case. My Internet Explorer wasn't working, you know, the way they expected. You do a right click, open a new tab.
Yep.
And it would open a new window. And you're like, well, why is that happening?
That seems weird. That seems like a bug.
Yeah, it seems like a bug,
yeah.
Except there's a code check, which you could argue is you know, I'm not sure why you put the code check like that, but it checks to see, you know, what the current mode is. And if you don't have UAC turned on, it gets the wrong answer.
Interesting.
And that's working around some of the security features in the IE browser that just aren't there without UAC enabled.
So right, where third-party, you know, nasty scripts were actually spinning up windows and creating new tabs and things.
Yeah, and there's you know, the whole protected mode and all that configuration.
Right.
So it's all in there for a very good reason, right? But the answer was, we're not going to fix it. If you turn UAC on, it does what it says, and that's a supported configuration.
Right.
And so, weird blowback, but
yeah, no, I think that would make people angry because you're making them behave better and they don't want to. I was happy the way things were, happily unprotected. Now you're insisting on me being protected. But I guess this is just a simple practice to start going through, turning on UAC and testing all your apps. It's just going to take some time.
Chances are, if you're in that situation, your Windows 7 deployment was way, way easier.
Right.
Because you're like, I don't know what everyone's talking about. This is not a problem for me, right?
I just turned it all off, right?
And everything worked.
Yeah, security by absence.
Yeah.
So,
and the other big thing we see is all the people who said, you know what, 32-bit Windows is great. I don't see why I would need anything else. And, you know, more and more we're seeing people looking at, staring down these machines with 16 and 32 gigs of RAM yeah. going, I really kind of want to go to 64 so I'm not just throwing away 3/4 of what I bought.
No kidding. Well, I haven't run a 32-bit version of Windows in a long time.
Yeah.
I made XP64 work, which was not easy. But yeah, so you folks, because that's a whole new set of drivers. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that has to be qualified if you're going to run 64-bit.
Yeah, well, that's, and a lot of it is actually because of drivers. Like, right. One example was I had a customer who had to deploy 32-bit on their Windows 7 image just because of a particular software and hardware config that they had.
Right.
And it's a neat scenario, right? Because what they're doing is they're controlling a piece of equipment that they are monitoring to see, hey, is everything okay?
Right.
Now, Ethernet doesn't guarantee a response going to come through. So they were using Token Ring, if you can believe that.
What?
Token Ring has a heartbeat.
Yes, of course it does. It's a token.
They would put it out there, and if ever a heartbeat didn't come in, they would shut it down.
Interesting.
So it's their way of saying, like, hey, we either shut it down if we hear a bad signal, or we shut down if we hear no signal.
Right.
But you can't do that with Ethernet. And there just were flat out no Token Ring drivers for 64-bit Windows. No one ever bothered to make them.
Of course, because that's a million, billion years ago.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
But until they redesigned the hardware and figured out another way to solve the problem.
Yeah. No, it's a programmer shortcut from years and years ago. That is technical debt.
Yeah.
That's what it really comes down to.
Exactly.
You did a clever shortcut and now you're paying your consequences going forward.
Yeah. So when you get into that situation, kind of the overall guidance we would say is, you're going to look an awful lot like everyone else's Windows 7.
Right.
Right. So we looked at the, sort of an average across everybody. And, you know, I always hesitate to give statistics, but then I give them anyway. Because they are potentially helpful, right?
Yes.
But, you know, as they say, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. You know, that's an old Mark Twain phrase.
Yep.
You know, obviously, some people do much better. Some people do much worse. But on average, we saw about 21% of applications coming off of XP to Windows 7 needed to be touched.
Right.
But if you didn't do all those features, you probably have to take a number of that percentage and go back and get them now because you didn't do it before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You just circumvented it. Now, our first anger at UAC was when it first showed up in Vista. And then even SP1 did some improvements on it. But I got to think the Win 10 version of UAC is dramatically better.
A ton of the changes actually went in even into what we did for Windows 7.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
By and large, the industry, first of all, got healthier.
Yep.
Because it did what it proposed to do. People think of UAC as prompts.
Yep.
And UAC is a whole lot more than prompts. It's sort of the foundational aspect of it. But really, UAC is a suite of security tools, one of which is giving you the ability to run as a full admin while appearing as if you are a standard user
right.
most of the time. Not as a security feature, but for a convenience feature for a developer who thinks I have to be admin all the time.
Right.
So they don't keep writing brand new code with unintended admin dependencies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that you can actually see that when you're pressing against that dependency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most of the time you don't actually need it. You just have to think a little differently about it.
Yeah.
Don't grab the directory the way you're grabbing it. Like there's any number of things they can do that you didn't need all this, but it was an easy way to grab it, but it requires higher privileges to do it.
Oh, and that's, I mean, we can go into a whole, you know, least privilege versus most privilege concept, but that's really true of, hey, I need to have this privilege maybe, so let me carry it all the time. I mean, even when we start talking about administration, which is not a topic on the topic here, but overall administration, we're also moving from a world of, hey, I might need to do this task that requires domain admin privileges, or I might need to get on this server and do this configuration that requires server admin privileges. So let me have on my key ring, like the janitors from the 1950s, 8,000 keys.
Right.
Of course, the problem is if someone takes and clones your key ring, now they have every single one of your keys because you're
just enough administration, right?
Yeah.
This is the new talking point about we define all the tasks out there that an admin needs to do, and we pretty much make accounts for each one of them, and that's all they do.
Mm-hmm.
And you only go into that account to do that task, and then you get back out. But you live most of the time as a domain user.
Yep.
So you're telling me UAC sort of has a way to make it feel like you are a domain user all the time, whether you are or not?
Well, the filter token.
Right. Yeah,
so if you're running as an admin with UAC enabled, it's going to filter your token and it's going to run with most of the privileges stripped out. Mm-hmm. It's going to take the administrator credential that you have in your token, that access control entry, and it's going to mark it as deny only.
Right.
So that I cannot use it to grant permission to something, but I can deny you permission if I said administrators can't get here.
Okay. That's interesting. So what happens when it runs into something where it really did need admin privileges?
then you would have to run it from an elevated context. So that's where the prompt comes
in. And that's when the prompt comes up and says, okay, you need administrative privileges now for this. Give me.
Well, kind of, right? That's a big misconception. There's no logic that determines, do you actually need to be an administrator? We don't run that logic. It's purely when you're starting an application, it's like, should this thing run as admin? Yes or no? Because it's per process.
Right.
And the answer comes down to, well, how does it know? So the first one is, well, the developer asked for it. They put into the application a little bit of XML that says, I need to be an admin.
Right.
Option B is, well, the IT pro asked for it. So that shim database, which we talked about in some of the previous conversations we've had and how to fix up busted apps, can also just put in a flag saying, hey, this one needs admin. Go ahead and prompt for it. And if no one chose to vote, the third one, which is actually something we put in Vista, because at one point, digging in the Wayback Machine, you know, we had a failure rate of around 80% in terms of applications, and it was mostly driven by the fact that they weren't installing.
Right.
So you had all these setup.exes that didn't trigger UAC and therefore didn't run as admin, and therefore they didn't actually drop bits, and that was a problem. And so we put in setup detection.
Right.
So if you're seeing a prompt and you don't know why, it's probably because it looks like a setup for some reason.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've even had that prompt show up later, which is, hey, did that install go well?
Yeah.
You know, just that which is really an interesting question to ask someone. It's like, I see it finished, but did it go well? Are you happy?
That's PCA, the Program Compatibility Assistant,
right,
where we, you know, sort of spot some evidence and we'll go in and say, well, maybe we should apply that reactively. So in that case, it's typically, if we see you trying to open and write a file into the program files directory,
right,
we'll go, hey, this is behaving kind of like a setup.
Mm-hmm.
So let's ask you later, like, was that supposed to be a setup? So at least now, yes, you're failing the first time.
Right.
But then we can fix it so that you work the second time.
Well, and there's two outcomes there. One is you did mean to install something, and yeah, go ahead and do that and elevate the privilege. And no, you didn't mean to install something, and thanks very much for failing that, because goodness knows what it was.
Yeah, let me please say, yeah, no, thank you. I don't want that.
Mm-hmm. So you have that chance. So the problem is if the average user is confronted with that, they press whatever button makes the box go away.
Mm-hmm. Whatever makes the dancing pigs come, I think, is the old analogy. Where's it give me the dancing pigs button?
I want the dancing pigs.
Yeah. So we got to go through and fix all that. So those are the two big warnings I would start with when I'm planning out is, hey, did I put something off?
Mm-hmm.
And so the general guidance that I would give to anyone is take whatever baseline configuration that's out there, the recommendation, and we certainly have them. We ship them in one way that we think is pretty secure, but pretty secure in a way that fits like the world.
Right.
Consumers, enterprises, small businesses, everyone. So obviously there's some compromise choices in there.
Sure.
We also have a baseline, the Microsoft security baselines, which are published, and we actually work really close with the government to build those out. And those security baselines we can use to say, if you have very, very deep security needs, right, here is a known and proven solution to accommodate them. So you can miss some of the gotchas that have existed. And there's been some funny gotchas that we've come across along the way. But you can miss those by using those. The idea is to get as close as possible to something that's known and is proven instead of rolling your own.
Yeah. So you don't have to validate everything. It's like, well, I went from this template that they tell me is right, and we made these three changes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really hard to set a template up for a consumer configuration versus an enterprise configuration. Like, as soon as you introduce something like group policy into the equation, you know, your security profile can look very different. That's that's a much different. And you know, I've run across plenty of, you know, SMB size organizations with an experienced IT guy who leans on group policy pretty heavily, and his security configuration is dramatically different from the non-technical organization, you know.
Yeah, well, that's why it's so important to get the defaults good enough.
Right. You guys are catching a lot of it. You have to get those defaults right.
And if I'm a giant financial services institution or a government agency, then I definitely want to look at the security baselines.
Yeah, but you've probably got a big security consultant coming in and so forth, and maybe they're starting from the templates, but I would argue most likely locking down even further.
Yep. Go into the baseline, which should be locked down. I would actually don't go bespoke unless you have a really good reason to.
Right, right. Because arguably, life is so much easier if you just recognize you're on a baseline that is known.
Yeah, because then we know it. And a great example, this is one of my favorite stories, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a privilege that you have in Windows called the SE debug privilege.
Okay.
And someone said, you know what? I don't think anyone needs to have that. Because the first thing you go by is most people think, I need that privilege if I want to debug programs.
Right.
Because of the name.
Yeah.
Turns out you don't, right? You can certainly debug programs without the debug privilege. The debug privilege allows you to get into another process on the system without having passed an access check.
Interesting.
So you jump into another process and do whatever you want to
in there. It's like a perfect virus vector. That's what that sounds like.
Having understood that, yeah, because, hey, it looks like a virus vector. Let's remove everybody from that.
Yeah.
So what are some of the side effects you can think of from removing everybody from that?
Software that's dependent on cross, non-authenticating cross-process calls.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of a lot of software that depends on that.
I can think of every single piece of commercially available database software will stop installing if you do that.
Right. Yeah.
Not, and it literally is every single one.
It's all of them.
So if your database server was already installed, everything was great, you were happy. And this was in a very, very early iteration of the, you know, we were developing at the time called the FDCC or the Federal Desktop Core Configuration.
Right.
Installed databases were fine, but you could not install a new database instance regardless of what your platform was. So no SQL, no Oracle, no DB2,
wow.
No MySQL, literally no new database. It's like George Bush back in the 90s. Read my lips. No new databases.
That's it. Yeah. Nothing's going to install. You're done.
So that's why I say, you know, you never know what those gotchas are going to be.
No.
Take the baseline. We work really hard to make the baseline be as secure as you need to be, even if you're a three-letter agency. And that way you also are in a known and proven solution and you miss the gotchas.
Chris, give me a second here to pay the bills because Run As Radio is brought to you by UpGuard. In the aftermath of data breaches, the public is often told we couldn't have seen it coming. But in a lot of cases, that's just not true. Over 80% of breaches have their root in misconfiguration, whether it be a firewall rule, server setting, open port, or third-party service. UpGuard is the premier system of record for IT configurations. No matter the platform, pinpointing anomalies and surfacing unauthorized changes in critical systems around the world. See how it works and get a live, customized demo at upguard.com/runasradio. Okay. Do we need to beat up UAC anymore? I mean, it's clearly better. It's worth doing the testing on it now. It's interesting, you know, the scenario you gave just before the break there. Test installs. You know, you could have applied that template and all the stuff you already got is working just fine. And then you go to install something new and we don't install databases every day and it's broken.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been broken for a long time. So it's interesting to think about the suite of tests I need to run as a responsible IT manager, to understand how the security profile is affecting my system.
True. So it's an interesting point. So let's pivot on that, right? How many tests should I run? How many should I not run? And this is something that I've been going after a lot. So, just a couple of weeks ago, I put out a ridiculously long blog post talking about recommendations for how should you handle your migration to Windows 10, both the initial migration and then subsequently, as you kind of hop onto the treadmill for Windows as a service, you know,
right.
How should you start behaving differently? And it really comes down to doing the right amount of testing, right? It doesn't mean doing all exhaustive testing, doesn't mean doing no testing. It means doing the right amount of testing.
Yeah. What do you need to explore to have some confidence?
Yeah. And I was reading a book yesterday and it really kind of brought out an example of something that I think bears thinking about in terms of how are you managing your risk?
Mm-hmm.
Are you managing your risk by saying, I have to be perfect all the time. Cost is no object.
Right.
And in this particular example, it was talking about how I believe it was in 1996 or 1998 or somewhere in there. It was at that point that they crossed the threshold where the federal government spent $2.2 billion processing expense submissions on $2 billion of expenses. We literally spent more money ensuring there wasn't fraud than we did actually doing the thing that we wanted to keep from being fraudulent.
That's funny.
And that's the kind of the mindset to be aware of is, well, I could, of course, test every single thing I find on any desktop in the organization exhaustively for every single change.
Right.
Except for then I very quickly run into the scenario of I spend more money doing this thing than I would end up spending if I just took the risk, realized the risk, and bought my way out of it.
Right.
And that's the tough bit. And that's what I'm trying to really help figure out more procedural ways to do things smart.
Because
I know you also don't want to go all the way back to, well, just don't test anything.
Just go for it. What's the big deal?
Some people have. I'll give you some numbers to kind of determine how much you want to do. Just give us what we're seeing. And what I will caveat this with is that the numbers we have on Windows 10 migrations are, by definition, early adopters.
Right.
So the early adopters have different software libraries than mainstream or laggard adapters. So we expect these to change over time. But right now we're seeing that people coming off of Windows 7 are experiencing roughly a 2% failure rate. Hmm. And people coming off of Windows 8 are experiencing a failure rate that's a fraction of a percent.
Wow.
It's not zero.
Yes.
But it's very, very small.
Close enough. So if your app is running in Windows 8, it's probably going to run in Windows 10.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, that's what we're seeing.
By a very high number.
Yeah.
Their question is that in a UAC is turned off configuration or UAC is turned on? Like, have you paid your debts?
Yeah, if I'm coming from a configuration where I don't generally change the configuration, that is an important caveat. If I take my group policies and I have a whole brand new set, well, policies themselves can also change what's happening there.
Sure. Well, and it makes sense to me when you are moving operating systems, like this is a good time to review a group policy set and look over some security profiles and generally think about all of these things because they're going to be impacted anyway. You might as well be ready.
Are you suggesting that the group policy that someone wrote as their high security template in 1999 might not still be the pinnacle of security today?
You're just talking crazy talk now, Mr. Jackson. Clearly.
We find that. I've seen, I've been using this browser policy since IE6. You're like, well, IE6 was kind of doors wide open.
Yeah.
You closed one barn door. We ship it with both barn doors closed and a couple of padlocks on it.
Yeah.
But by leaving it at your secure configuration from 10 years ago, you're actually being a lot less secure than if you did nothing.
Yeah, no kidding. And we put so much effort into that first set of security plans X many years ago. And it's really hard to revisit it regularly. You know, that's just an expensive proposition and not a pleasant one either.
Well, a really good piece of advice I got, and this was from one of the guys within Microsoft who does DevOps, and I am just a horrible human being for not remembering his name. but he put something out there that really struck a chord with me. Mm-hmm. And he said, you should question everything, but you should question everything exactly once.
Right.
And once you've resolved it, do not go back there and visit it again.
Sure.
You've resolved it.
Yeah.
So you should go back and go, should we go back and review this? And if your answer is no, here's why, it's really good. Accept your answer and be done.
Right. But then the requirements change. New versions of software, new operating systems, and you kind of have to go back and review those things again.
Then you go and question it because of the change in the environment, not because you're feeling indecisive.
Of course, now the interesting thing here is Win 10 is never going to have another version of an operating system. It's the last operating system ever. When do we do that evaluation?
Depends on how you define version.
I guess that's true, right? So at the anniversary switch, which is roughly a year later, you know, that's a fairly big set of changes. It's a good question.
It is a good question, right? And I would say it kind of depends upon, you know, the overall risk, right? To be measuring that is I want to look at where do I see potentially significant risk and evaluate there, and really gauge that and trust but verify. So one of these things, behaviors that we've been stressing a lot lately has been I would prefer to take an approach that's very iterative. Mm-hmm. So rather than take all of my things, go through all of them in one giant monolithic project, and when I'm done, push go.
Yep.
To move to a model where, hey, I'm going to start going, and I'm going to say, you know, hey, this is, you know, really, really easy, very straightforward. Let me test a small group.
Yep.
And then collect my data and use that as justification. Because you can hear some schmuck like me saying, hey, 2% or fraction of a percent failure rate, and you may be unlucky. Again, right. They're statistics, right?
Sure.
And someone's going to be the unlucky one, and maybe yours is 5%. Who knows? Regardless, right, I can trust but verify. If I'm doing them all, then I've got to do this massive project and have this unknown risk, whereas instead I can start to gain some momentum, deploy some of the easy seats. You know, one of the great models of deployment methodologies I've seen was in the now defunct Continental Airlines.
Right.
They would go roll by roll. They would say, let's start off with the gate agent. Because the gate agent runs about 5-10 pieces of software, you know, in the legacy Continental Airlines.
Sure.
They could do all of them and deploy to every single person in that role. Because once that software works, they knew they were good. And they would get some momentum. They'd see the risk. And they'd see in their environment, the way we write software, we fail at this rate.
Hmm.
And then they go on to the gate readers, which is a little scanner. That's
right.
Like 3 pieces of software. I was surprised it was that many. But it's a small number of software.
But
this
kind of
makes sense
to take a small footprint. We know these apps really well. It's not very many of them. It's a particular role. So you're broad enough, but it's relatively shallow.
Yeah.
You know, it won't be that hard to fix it up and keep moving.
Yeah. And for doing the inverse, by getting some of the depth testing, another good practice I picked up from another customer of mine, would have the, they called it the department technical coordinator, the one person on each team that loved technology. And they, what was in it for them was always they would get the newest gadget.
Right.
So I remember when they, the, it was a Lenovo X1 Carbon Touch. That they were really hot about back when it first came out. It was one of the very first Ultrabooks.
Still great machines, but back in the day, they were so far ahead of their time.
Yeah.
It's a very sexy computer.
It was the beginning of the Ultrabook. It was back when you had the MacBook and you had the big, thick, heavy Windows
that's
books
right.
were your two choices. And all of a sudden, you actually had one that was thin
was
and
the,
nice.
Like the Carbon one and the and Asus made one, but it was just like there was a three or four of these first Ultrabooks.
Yeah.
It's a big deal at the time.
So they gave him one.
Yeah.
And then like, and then you're going to be on the initial deployment. And so we start talking about Windows as a service. You've got these rings that you can put people through. We've
right.
got current branch for business, which is what we recommend for most businesses. Current branch comes before that, but you can start getting into some of the insider branches before that. And a lot of it can just be canary in a coal mine. What if I just start pushing out much more frequent distributions
sure.
to a very small group of people who have backup machines or access to backup systems mm-hmm. so they can start seeing that depth while we do the breadth for the push deployments.
Yeah, and then they're more likely to pick stuff up too because they are technically enthusiastic and technically savvy.
Yeah.
So yeah, not a bad candidate for finding all those things. And of course, this all becomes really important because of this idea that Win 10 wants to continuously slip updates into your system. And you know, some enterprises are sticking with the WSUS sort of, we're going to pile these up. We're going to test them all at once. We'll roll them out when we roll them out. But I mean, by default, Win 10 is always trying to grab updates and install them by itself.
Well, yeah, you can still control it. I mean, certainly the huge change that came about was rather than having it be piecemeal, mm-hmm. I'd like these three updates, but not these four.
Right.
Right. And then we had a nice blog post explaining it, but it really comes down to if I give you 13 things in 1 month and you picked 10 of them and didn't pick three. Well, we don't have a test case that takes all of the possible permutations.
Right.
I did the math for this for someone. I kind of went through and said, all right, of all the updates that we've released just for Windows 7, how many different permutations do you have of all of the updates that came out? And it turns out that not enough nanoseconds have elapsed since the beginning of time for us to have run 1 nanosecond tests for every single configuration. And yes. a 1 nanosecond test wouldn't be very telling, but that's the kind of combinatorial explosion
yeah,
you get
it's
that makes it.
It's factorial. It's N to N minus one, right?
It is.
And you guys make a lot of patches.
Yeah.
It's good that they're rolled up. It just, you know, I just think of from a PSS point of view, from a support point of view. How do we know what your configuration is if everybody has their own choice in patches?
I can tell you that at least 30% of all cases that came into product support on the browser
mm-hmm.
had to do with that particular organization's configuration of the browser
right.
and did not reprone a default configuration.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting problem in general. So still okay with the enterprise approach to you can go and test for updates and then roll your updates out on your own time, but certainly at the consumer level. And I think for most SMBs, they're just not controlling it anymore. They're just happening.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
And if you don't break stuff,
it doesn't really matter. Things. As long as you don't break stuff, because there have been some incidents.
Oh, yeah. It happens.
Yeah.
And I think the intent of that is to reduce the amount of time that it happens mm-hmm. because it allows us to do more testing in a smaller number of scenarios. So
sure.
we can actually focus on really improving the quality rather than making sure that this patch will work if you did not take these other four patches
right.
that may target the exact same DLL.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The interesting side of all of this is just dealing with when stuff breaks, how long does it take to recover? You know, what do you got to look for? How do you figure it out? It's, you know, it's nice if the sign popped out of the machine went, oh, I'm having a compatibility problem. But it's never that simple, right? The software runs, but this one particular feature goes weird. Like diagnosing those things can be very challenging.
Yeah, it definitely can. I mean, it certainly kept me busy over the years.
Sure.
I was just actually earlier today doing some troubleshooting for a customer who just reached out to me by email. It's on
right.
a long shot, I think. He's like, listen, I'm working with someone on this. My developers are telling me this. Can you troubleshoot that? It happened to be an issue that I actually knew really well. I've been meaning to blog about it, to be honest.
Right.
That's a really old bit of code. I don't want to name the guilty, right? Because this
yeah.
one is not praiseworthy. They didn't do anything wrong. They just did something that's different. We changed the way that we do prototype calls in the Chakra JavaScript engine versus the legacy JavaScript engine. And it causes a change in behavior that causes this particular component to break. No one could have seen that coming, right? We were debugging it for a long time. It was a gnarly issue.
Right.
And that's where you have that expertise that comes in. The fortunate thing is that you know, we don't have to do that as much. And so we have a much smaller need for bringing in those deep experts. But an ancillary point to that is getting some awareness. So even before you start troubleshooting it, and this is becoming more and more prevalent, and we're seeing it as we get deeper into this Windows as a service mechanism of rapid updates. What do you think is the single largest predictor, single most reliable predictor of whether or not an application is going to break with a new update to Windows 10?
The most likely thing, I mean, I would presume it needs admin privileges.
Nope.
No. Communicates on the network.
It's whether it broke last time. it's this concept of application brittleness.
Yes.
Is, you know, if you broke last time, you're probably going to break this time too.
If you're
too.
A troubled app in Win 7, you're probably a troubled app in Win 8 and Win 10.
And so rather than having it be a sporadic once every 5 years deep dive debugging session with some expert that you've now got to go dig up, if instead you're like, wow, this software always breaks, maybe it's time to re-architect that software rather than continuing to be surprised the next time when it breaks again.
Interesting.
And we're seeing that be fairly reliable, which is let's go back and address that, right? And we, one customer is working on a whole new system that really is fundamental to their business. And it was that bit of evidence. It's like, you know, this is keeping me from doing all of these changes because every single thing I do, patches are breaking it.
Yeah.
Updates are breaking it. So browser brittle. Updates are breaking it. Let's address the brittleness.
Yeah, that's really interesting to take it on from that perspective. And I can't say this enough, but I don't call PSS very often. But when I do, the experience is excellent. Like, they really do hammer away the problem. My usual reaction at the end of a PSS call is I should have called sooner. Like, I whacked my head against the keyboard too long. And they actually are quick at finding these kinds of problems and drilling into them.
I find that very easy to believe. Mm-hmm. And if we actually ran during the retirement of IE11. So we went end of life on April 14th of, was that 2015? Last year?
Last year.
Yeah. So, a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
Has it really been a year and a half? Am I that old, Richard? Is that what happened?
IE11 retirement.
Is it this year or last year? I'm getting flags in the background from my assistant. That it was 2016. So it was about
year.
6 months ago. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So regardless, right? So in the run up to helping really get over any of the compatibility issues that folks had, obviously we knew it was a big task that they were going through. I enlisted the help of a couple of our best engineers from customer support.
Right.
And so that was, you know, how we solved the overwhelming majority of the issues that came up is we just put it in the hands of one of these engineers and they would just dig to the bottom of it and figure out here's exactly what's going on. Here's what we could change in the code to get it. Just absolutely brilliant. Right.
It's awesome.
So I agree.
Yeah. It's fantastic. Chris, always fun to talk to you. It's always a challenging area to work in as things continue to move along.
But, I'm actually surprised before we shut this down, you never asked me why is Windows 7 higher than Windows 8 in terms of statistics?
I did not ask you that, but I would just presume there's an awful lot of people that are going 7 to 10. Lots of people skipped 8.
There is a ton, yeah. And so the interesting thing, and I point this out just because it actually helps you to go faster.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why there's a higher percentage of failures going from Windows 7 to Windows 10 versus Windows 8 to Windows 10 is because in Windows 8.1, we put in a very clever bit of engineering.
Mm-hmm.
That engineering is that we now lie by default about what version of Windows you are.
Right.
So if you ask Windows 8.1, hey, what version are you? It'll say, I'm 8.0. Nice to meet you. You ask Windows 10, what version of Windows are you? It will say, I'm Windows 8.0. It's nice to meet you.
Mm-hmm.
Until you put in an application manifest, a little bit of XML into your application saying, Windows 10, I'm cool. I know who you are. I'm not going to do anything stupid. Go ahead and tell me the truth. Because that was always like the one thing we could never figure out is that everyone, I have to write a program. I got a new assignment. So step one, check and verify whether I have Windows 7 or not.
Right.
Which is crazy if you think about it. If I'm an enterprise customer, you know what you're saying when you write that bit of code?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if my IT pro has done his job.
Right.
Because their job is to deploy Windows 7 everywhere. And I'm saying, I don't believe you could do it.
So I'm going to check. I'm going to validate that.
And I'm going to check every single time you launch me, hundreds of thousands of times.
Wasn't this the core argument for why that we went from 8 to 10? Because there were 9s before, and doing version checking with the number 9 was going to be really, really dangerous?
That was just a rumor, actually.
Okay.
Yeah,
not true.
Because if you ask Windows 95 what version of Windows it was, it would say I'm version 4.0.
Right, 4 something.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, was it 4.0 for 95? 98 was 4.5 or 4.0. Like I'd have to dig into the Wayback Machine, but it didn't actually say that. And there was nothing that was doing the translation.
So why did we skip 9 then?
I think that was just marketing. I think it was just to put some distance in between it. As all, you know, yeah. I don't know the official definition. Yeah. So you'd have to go and talk to someone there. But that was sort of my perception. Is let's just, you know, really kind of almost catch it up, right? Because there was because there was a lot of things that got put in place. Like Windows 7 was technically version 6.1, and Windows 8 was 6.2, and we kind of didn't name a couple in between there. So I think it was really just if we looked back and we had kind of kept the NT version numbers going, we would have been at 10. Like there was some logic and there was some emotion. It was a kind of mixture of both, but that's kind of where that came from. But
stop doing that.
Yeah,
stop
we lie by default now, so that kind of makes that go away.
It's not going to work for you anymore. We're circumventing it. All right, Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show again.
A pleasure.
And we'll talk to you next week on Ron As Radio.